I want to read a passage from Romans chapter 12. Listen to these words. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. The word of God for the people of God. As we think about this passage tonight, I want to invite up a very special guest from South Africa, Father Michael Lapsley. Father, will you join me here? He is the father of the Anglican variety, if you're wondering what I mean when I say Father Michael. So welcome. It's so good to have you here.
It's the first time I knew I was part of the Anglican variety, but thank you for the revelation.
He's here for an event that's happening after this service. Actually, it's happening in the loft, which is why we're here. And since this event was happening and I heard that you were coming, I knew we had to have you come here and share some of your story. And before we get really to the heart of your story, which I find so inspiring, in some ways challenging for how I live and how I view things in my life, I want to go back, and I'm going to go back quite a ways, to New Zealand, because you were born in New Zealand. And I understand that at a very early age, you sensed this call.
Well, when I was four, I had this crisis. I couldn't decide when I grew up whether to be a clown in the circus or a priest in the church.
Are they really that different? Or,
well,
no, I'm kidding.
When I became a priest, my brother sent me a message, said, now you've succeeded at both.
And so you left New Zealand and went to
Australia
to study, to be ordained. And then from there, you were sent to South Africa.
In my order said, what would I like to do next? And I said, oh, I'd love to go to Japan. They said, oh, that's great. We'll send you to South Africa. They called it the vow of obedience.
Yes, and they were testing you. And you faithfully followed through. And when you arrived there, not thinking that when you felt this call, that this would be the path you'd be on, this would be the place that you would arrive, what was it like for you when you first arrived in South Africa?
Well, I often say that the day I arrived in South Africa, I stopped being a human being and I became a white man. Because suddenly, every single aspect of my life was decided by the color of my skin. The suburb that I lived in, the university I studied in, the elevator that I could use, the bathroom I could use, even the part of the sea I could swim in. So for me, whiteness became like leprosy. If only I washed often enough, maybe it would go away and I could become a human being. And in a way, joining the liberation struggle was about joining the struggle to recover my own humanity in solidarity with black people struggling for their own basic human rights.
And you were there in a time at the height of apartheid, when the racism and the racist policies were at their peak, and the anti-apartheid movement was gaining momentum, and you ended up becoming a part of that in South Africa.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's important to say that particularly through into the 80s, struggle against apartheid became an issue for all humanity. I mean, you could go nowhere in the world without finding people who are involved in the struggle against apartheid, not least people in the faith community. But the turning point for me and for my generation was 1976, when school children began to be shot on the streets of South Africa. And of course, for me, the most traumatic thing in terms of my faith was the fact that those who shot children went to church on Sunday. I read the Bible every day. And shot children. So that somehow racism had so entered their souls that they didn't see a child like their child. They saw something black rather than, you know, a fellow human being.
And as you saw that and recognized it and joined the struggle to end that, it ultimately led to you being exiled from South Africa.
Yes, just after the events of Soweto, when the school children began to be killed, I became the national chaplain for Anglican students for the whole country. Then I was expelled from the country. I went to live in Lesotho. Now, I know that people in the United States are slightly geographically challenged.
Only slightly. So, yes.
So I'm sure everybody here knows where Lesotho is. Yes?
Yes. They all know it's a small little country nestled within South Africa.
Okay, you teach geography in this church.
No, I actually read up before you got here.
So, yeah, completely. It's interesting. It was the place where Desmond Tutu first became a bishop, was in Lesotho. So we used to say we lived in the belly of the monster. And so it was there that I applied to join the African National Congress of South Africa, the organization of Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. And so I became a priest within the liberation movement for the following 16 years.
And through your involvement there, there are obviously people who wanted to uphold apartheid that were deeply opposed to this and willing to use violence to prevent change.
And yeah, well, I think I'm glad you use that word, because I think sometimes the words we use mystify situations. So when the apartheid state had violent laws and used violence against the people, it was called the defense of law and order. When the people, who remember were voteless but were the majority, picked up weapons after 50 years of nonviolent struggle, people said it's violence and terrorism. So the very language that was used mystified rather than revealed the reality of the situation.
And when you were there, one day you receive a package in the mail. And can
well,
you say what
I
happened?
I lived first in Lesotho, yeah. And then I, because of a massacre there, I had to leave and went to live in Zimbabwe. In the beginning of 1990, Nelson Mandela gets released from prison after 27 years. The regime says, we're going to talk, we're going to negotiate. 3 months after that, I received two religious magazines in the post. When I opened them, they exploded, and that's how I lost my hands and eye, eardrums shattered. But somehow, in the midst of that indescribable pain, I had a sense that God was with me in the midst of that situation.
And I understand that the package actually was an attempt to assassinate you, in a sense, right?
The way you opened it
actually saved your life, I understand.
Well, I opened it on a small coffee table. If I had opened it on a table like this, it would have either knocked off the head or knocked off the heart. So the exact angle, in that sense, saved my life. So it was a bomb that was not supposed to injure. It was a bomb that was supposed to kill. And I also felt that, yes, God was with me. I also knew that I had won and they had lost because I was alive. And so, in a sense, the journey from there was the journey of appropriating that victory.
And this is what's remarkable to me, is having that kind of violence used against you in an attempt to end your life, somehow you had this sense that God was with you, that you had won, they had lost, and your journey has taken you to a place where you work towards the healing of memories and reconciliation. How did you get from what was done to you to the place where you're working for these things?
I think the key to that, very important question, is that in the 14 years before the bomb had gone off, I had lived in the countries of Southern Africa, but I had traveled the world as part of the struggle against apartheid. So when I was bombed, there were messages of prayer, love, support from people all over the world, from Christians, from Muslims, from Jews, from Hindus, from atheists, from communists. So I was accompanied on my journey of healing. I had excellent medical treatment first in Zimbabwe, then in Australia, but it was the prayer, love, and support of people accompanying me that enabled me to make my bombing redemptive, to bring life out of death, good out of evil. So in a way, when I created with others the Institute for Healing of Memories, I was, if you like, returning the compliment of what was done with me and for me. So it was the fact that I was accompanied on my journey of healing. My story was acknowledged, reverenced, recognized. People say what happened to me was wrong. But when I returned to South Africa, after being away for 16 years, I discovered a damaged nation, a damage in our humanity. But for millions of South Africans, their stories, unlike mine, had not been acknowledged and reverenced and recognized. And no one said what happened to them was wrong. So all they had, in a sense, was their victimhood. So I began to discover a calling to create what we like to call safe and sacred spaces where people can deal with how the past of the nation has affected them, how the past of their parents and grandparents has affected them, and also even the hurt sometimes happens in church. The church that as well has affected people, and the kind of, you know, so a holistic view of healing. You know, often when we think of healing, especially in the church, we think about me and Jesus or me and the church, but we don't often think about how the nation's journey has affected us. And I suppose, in a sense, the ribbons I've seen outside this church for many years bear testimony to that, of how a national story, a country that keeps going to war, affects the lives of individuals.
I think that's such an amazing thing, and I'm wondering this because we haven't experienced, in a sense, the kind of trauma you may have experienced and others. Some of us may have, but we do experience trauma. And when we do, it's easy to have anger well up within us. It's easy to have hate well up within us. It's easy to think that the most satisfying thing in the world could be revenge. And yet that's not the path you chose. Did you have any of those inclinations afterwards that in your healing that you had to work through? And what can we learn from that and what you do?
I mean, I think first the things you mentioned, anger, hatred, bitterness, revenge, are all normal human responses to terrible. Not that everybody has them, but they're normal responses when terrible things happen to us. I think the first point in the journey of healing is when I say, yeah, I'm filled with hatred, but it's messing me up. I want revenge, but I'm being damaged by it. And that's the point that then there can be the possibility. In my case, I never really hated or wanted revenge. I think for me, the deepest feeling was one of grief. You know, we think here, all of us at some point in our lives have lost loved ones, have passed away. And if we've deeply loved someone, we will always grieve for them. Now, losing your limbs is like that. So in a sense, I will always grieve for my hands that I've lost. I feel some anger in our context to the political leaders of the old order who never tortured anybody, who didn't kill anybody, but they passed laws that caused pain and suffering to millions and millions of people. But otherwise, yeah, I suppose in a way that thinking of those emotions, the journey of healing is about detoxification. It's recognizing I've got the stuff in me, but in order to live my life, I've got to let it go. What was that first hymn we sang tonight? What was it again?
Trading My Sorrows.
Trading My Sorrow. I mean, beautiful hymn, but trading my sorrows can be a journey of many years of finding the way of being able to let go of that stuff. I mean, it's great we sing it because it inspires us and encourages us, but we should also recognize it's a journey step by step to get to that healing.
And you made reference earlier that for you and the work you do that is helping others find what you found, that is a community that holds that with you as you share your story, right?
Yes. In our work, we bear witness to the importance of having other people or collective journeys of healing. You know, people come to our workshops and they arrive and they sit in rows and they're there with a pen and paper and Father's going to heal us. So the first thing we say, okay, put your pen and paper down. Let's sit in a circle and we tell each other our stories. And in that process, we become healers of one another. And in fact, what connects us is our pain. It is our pain shared in a safe space, which becomes transcendent. And in the commonality of our pain, we find our common humanity. And then we begin to, if you like, take back agency, or to move from being victims to survivors to victors, which of course is the Easter story, but also to become participants in the struggle for justice and reconciliation. You know, it's very interesting in the New Testament, so often when people are healed, their response to being healed is to follow Jesus on the way. So healing is not an end in itself. What enables us, if you like, to become wounded healers and to be part of God's project for the human family.
Now, two questions, and I know you have an event to get to in a minute. Two more questions. Yeah, I'm thinking if anybody is here who's carrying the weight of hurt within their lives and trauma within their lives, what counsel would you give to them in this moment?
I think the important thing is when we've got that stuff in us and we're damaging us, is to find safe spaces where we are able to share. And our safe space can be our intimate partner. It can be a counselor, a wise friend, it can be a soulmate, but we all need to find, and of course some of us are able to find the way to healing in a space of quiet. I think God is not limited in the way God heals human beings, but I have no doubt that God's will is that we should all be on journeys to healings. Because you made reference earlier, none of us will travel this earthly life without degrees of pain. The question is, does it continue to imprison us, or are we able step by step to become free?
When you speak that way, it reminds me
of course, they can look at our website as well.
Yes, they can.
Healing of Memories.
Healing of Memories.
You ask
more information.
Ms. Google, Healing of Memories.
Okay.
And even the chairperson of our board, Linda Rich from Hawaii, is here in this group. So you can say hi to Linda as well.
Welcome. It's great to have you here tonight. It reminds me of Lou Smead's work on forgiveness. And he says that when we're able to forgive, we realize that we set the prisoner free, and the prisoner was us.
Yes, I think forgiveness is about healthy selfishness. It's interesting, the same word in the Gospels for forgiveness is the same word for untying a knot. Mm. It's what I need to do in order to be free. But church people speak of forgiveness as something glib and cheap and easy. Most human beings find it costly, painful, and difficult. And sometimes when we're hurting, we don't need the pastor to preach a sermon on forgiveness. We need a hug. We need our pain to be heard and acknowledged. And then one day we may choose to travel the journey of forgiveness.
And what you point to is the need for us as a community of faith to be a safe place, a place where people can be vulnerable.
It's part of our vocation.
Yes.
To be that. Yeah, indeed.
Second question, and here's the second, is we are called as a community to be instruments of healing, instruments of reconciliation. What should we be paying attention to? What can we be doing? How can we more fully live into that?
I think the key thing is to be open to listen to the pain of the human family and the pain of Mother Earth. Mother Earth is hurting and angry. And so there's an incredibly important, I mean, it's sort of glib, but has a truth to it. It's not accidental that God, when she made us, gave us two ears and one mouth. No? So to be willing to hear the pain of the human family. And be a place, you know, when we were trained as pastors, we were taught to preach. How much were we taught to listen? To be places where this community of faith can continue to be open to hearing the pain and to be allow ourselves to be transformed by. I recommend that everyone in the United States should get a passport, have their lips sewn up, travel across the world, listen to the pain of the human family, and come back and be missionaries here in the United States. Can you arrange the sewing up as part of the work of this church?
We can work on it. Right? We can work on it. We can work on it. But that's great advice. You're right. Thank you for that. I want to invite one more person to join us now, and that is Antti Pentikäinen. Welcome. We're so glad to have you here. Now, Antti has years of experience working in peace and reconciliation, and he's here because we're helping host an event for a new Center for Reconciliation, the Mary Hoke Center for Reconciliation at George Mason University, and he is going to be its founding director. So welcome. Tell me, how did you get connected to the importance of this kind of work in reconciliation and healing and all that the center envisions doing?
Well, first of all, Michael, let me thank you for inviting me here. I had always the wish that whatever I'm launching could be based on prayer. And I actually ask you to pray, not necessarily for me, but those reconcilers of the world who, like Michael Lapsley, are taking risks and sometimes paying it with their lives. And often they're ostracized from the communities they're trying to heal. So please continue in your prayers. And if you can include that in your weekly prayer, the reconcilers of the world and your communities, it would be the greatest service that you can do. So Mary Hoke actually was a member of Reformed Church in New York area. And her name doesn't represent the president's name. It represents one of us. And the key message there is that everyone can be a reconciler. And that is my message to you. All of you, you can be a reconciler. And if you go into that journey, the Mary Hoke Center wants to accompany this community and you as an individual We are established at university because we want to collect the practices like Father Michael and you, so they would be known by the others and inspiring others also on this journey. My personal story is that I've been on peace mediation for 20 years, on negotiation table with Slobodan Milosevic, with the other actors helping people in those negotiation tables. And it felt like I had walked over this treasure in the field, not noticing it, until I realized that there is this incredible power of human mind to heal. That's in every tradition, every community, and every human being, and all of us struggle with that. And I just felt that this is the missing piece. If we can't figure out how to support it, we will fail peace. So the center is set up to research and help to get the skill known and inspire the reconciler in everyone.
And I think part of the work is, often when we think of reconciliation in the world, we think of diplomats, high-level meetings, but I know part of the work is really helping grassroots level stuff, people like us in the communities in which we live find a way to be reconcilers in the world.
Exactly, and what I have realized, having focused on war zones, having spent in and out about 10 years in Somalia, I realized that things have changed back home. And the dichotomy between the work in the war zones and our communities has to be over. We need reconcilers everywhere, and we need to learn from each other. And there's something that we have learned overseas that we might be providing, and there's something you have learned that you can give to us. So we should create a community where we support each other. Something that we have been starting in Finland, so I'm coming from Finland, is a movement of reconciliation. So it's based on three principles. Reconciliation as a right. So if you face a dispute, whether it's a workplace, whether it's in community, whether it's in a church, whether it's in a family, you should call for reconciliation. You have a right for it. It's a skill. It's a skill that you can practice. You can go for education. You can try it. And it's an obligation. When you see something, say something. Express your willingness to listen, like Michael was advising, and be available in whichever way your heart is speaking to move forward.
Well, I know we need to get you to another event at which you're both speaking in just a few minutes, but I want to thank you, Auntie, Father Michael, thank you so much for being here and for the work you do. It's courageous work, needed work, and work with which we want to partner with you and join. So thank you again for all you do.
Michael, I was so honored to be invited, and I'm so honored to be here with Michael Lapsley. Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Marble, for being such a beacon in this city and this world.
Pray for us, and we'll pray for you.
Absolutely. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.